You're listening to the Law of Attraction Radio Network.
Welcome to Quantum Leap Book Club. During the next hour, beloved mind scientist Parisha and her guests from around the world will read and discuss various best-selling books with well-known authors. Every show will apply retention techniques designed to help you to absorb powerful knowledge to effectively change your life. Join us every week for a thought-provoking hour and re-listen as often as you can. You will be delighted by what you learn, and you will be excited by the results. Are you ready to take the quantum leap? Here's Parisha.
Greetings, and welcome to Quantum Leap Book Club. This is your host, Parisha, and my co-host this week. My faithful co-hosts are with me, and that would be Mike Delar, Rosemary Heyer. That will be... Okay, I got Marianne Love here. I've got Geraldine Dalby-Ball, and I've got Trina, and I've got Joyce Mollenhauer. So we're pretty much a full house here, which is definitely going to be a fun night. This week, because we really don't have a book that we are focusing on, we actually wanted to do something fun for us and something that kind of exposes us to you more, our listeners. Okay, because we our interests are so widespread. And what excites us the most is the unheard of and the unexplored and the new undefined part of our world. Your co-host and I don't necessarily live in the mundane world of daily activities and the routine of things. Whilst we do have organization and routine, we look and always are beyond time and space. And so looking for what's on the leading edge of development and science and what's really happening. How massive and big is our world and our life? We lock ourselves into situations like right now. We are looking to start our new program. And this program will be actually covering each week new and exciting things that aren't in the normal news spread and isn't necessarily anything you would have heard of because it's in development state or it's still in some particular private studies. But we want to start bringing that in because right now, the particular political arenas, especially in the United States, are starting to heat up. And people are again locked into all of the emotions of the COVID and all of the particular mandates that people are going through and everything else to where they're beginning to actually settle for it. In other words, it's becoming a jaded, fixed part of us. And that was intentional. And my intention is to disturb that. Okay. So we want you thinking about something else. And we want you to thinking about things that actually make you think, because it might not make sense to you right away. And if not making sense to you, it might not even be believable for you right away. So we actually want you to encounter that and begin to explore that. Pull yourself out of the quagmire and actually look at a bigger picture of our world. When we look at the extraordinary development of the sciences, especially the quantum field, and we have now come to understand ourselves as pure energy. So we are not just matter and form, we are energy. And what of us that we have never understood as foreverness or the hereafter or the everlasting is that energy? Yes, the body wears out. It has a timeline. It actually has a modality of how it expresses itself. It is a living organism. It is engineered and it is of use and works with us as far as energy. When we begin to try and digest that, and we hear all in the marketplace, well, you're not the body. That's common saying these days, but do we understand that? Okay, well, we're moving around and we understand we have backaches, we have this, we have that, whatever, we're hungry, whatever. We begin to realize, well, that's the body. But what is it that's listening to the body? What is it that's actually identifying the messages of the body and what goes to try and take care of what that is? So we've entered a field of exploring and trying to understand the greater awareness of what we are as far as being part of the eternalness of time, space, and matter. So in doing that, okay, we've now gotten a diversion from those particular perceptions and those pursuits. And now we've got into all of this insanity that's going on around the world. Okay. I want us to stay on the track of looking into that which is not understood yet. I want you to start looking at it and thinking about it. I want you to realize that that's going on right now as well. And that what's going on right now is a much, much bigger picture than what people are dealing with up front and personal. The fear that's beginning to breed and increase, it has to have a place to begin to relax and explore itself from a much bigger picture than the present. So me and the co-hosts are going to take a jab at this today and actually share some stuff and some stuff that's excited us. And we hope that you'll give me some good feedback about that. And right after this show this week, we will actually be taking up a new book. And it's one that Trina has actually suggested that I like the sound of. And as soon as my co-hosts respond to what they think on that, we'll let you know what that book is. But for right now, we're just going to play in the weird and the bizarre of all things in time space that we just don't talk about on a normal basis. So come have tea and sit down and realize that for a while, you're just going to talk to the randomness of space and time. So I'm going to let any of you co-hosts start that feel you've got something juicy to pull our interest with.
I'll start, grandmother.
Why did I know that, Michael?
It was funny because as you were talking earlier about things, I was looking at this story and I was thinking, wow, this just really fits what we're talking about, because it's one of those stories that you read it and you go, I don't really know how I feel about that. And let me share it with you. Apparently, MIT, you know, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, wants to replace lights with growing plants, and they make the plants glow.
Really?
What they've done, but apparently this started off in December of 2017. They embedded some nanoparticles in the plants genetically. And so the plants actually absorb light during the day and then slowly give it off at night.
Mm.
And it's part of this new field of engineering called nanobiotics, which is basically taking nanocomputers, which are very, very small atom-sized computers, and blending them with organic biology, human or animal, or plant in this case, and creating an outcome. So in a way, it's like, wow, we save a whole bunch of energy because this all becomes very subtle and beautiful and natural and free. But the other side is like we're messing with nature. So I kind of throw it out to you there because this is the research that they're doing.
I'm excited about that. Okay. I've actually had some stories told to me by my elders as a child and everything of a time when we were in family and harmony with nature, and that the plants provided us light after the sun went down. So that is extremely interesting. And so I would be happy to see that development myself. Any of you co-hosts have a comment? In fact,
I can say that it,
mind you, Michael seems to have some lights of its own. Yeah, Geraldine.
I was just thinking it reminds me of the glowing fungi that is already present our forest. And if anyone's seen that movie Avatar, there's certain films in there that shots in there that look amazingly out of this world, but they are actually real. And it also brings to mind just recently that I was rowing a boat at night on a new moon and it was dark, and the bioluminescence was phenomenal. Every time the oar went in the water, it just glistened out this green, and you think, if we were creating a computer game, what is the magnificence that could even think of the beauty that it comes when we talk about bioluminescence?
Yes,
bioluminescence is almost, one would say, out of this world.
Well, we're going to bring it into this world, according to Michael said. There's people already working on it. So
it's really interesting that you said that. Sorry for me for jumping in, Geraldine, but actually the this nanoparticle that they've got is coated with a substance, strangely enough, called luciferase.
Luciferase.
It's a substance that's found in fireflies.
Oh, yes.
They're Isn't that fun. Cool?
Yeah.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah. Very good. And I guess we'll learn more of what actually causes it to illuminate. But that's also
it's programmed into the little nanobots, and they're I guess dispersed throughout the plant, probably by its own natural circulation. This is early stages, but you can kind of see where it might go. You know, it would look pretty cool, I could imagine.
Yeah, well, my thoughts of having it to where it actually comes to be something that we can control, like turning it on after dark, or when we go close to it, it illuminates. You know, instead of it just being there working off its own time, does it react to our need at all? So that's really cool, very much so. All right. Thank you, Michael, for that one. I'll be ready for another one soon. Geraldine, since you engaged, do you have one to share with us?
Yes. Well, I guess we can continue on that mode of the fungus and things that glow, because what I found out is, and this, some of this is old news, that fungi break things down, but there's been so much research lately, not only on the plastics, but even on DDT and metals. So they're doing more and more research as they find fungi, and they're also finding the equivalent of 3 new species of fungi every couple of months. So it's not only that we've got fungi, that they're doing these amazing things of breaking down materials, and they do that by excreting chemicals straight from their cellular structure onto whatever the item is, including plastics, metals, pesticides, and breaking them into more simple compounds. And those simple compounds are then, one can picture it like Lego. It breaks apart and then you can rebuild it. But what they're finding is the more that they look, the more the diversity of fungi has the answers to what we already are looking at. Like there's a new fungi that's been looked at that grows on the side of birch trees. And this has tremendous abilities in managing colds and flus and those viruses. So right under our nose, we've got so much research going on about how fungi helps us break down matters with their enzymes. And that's a little bit there. And it includes the latest ones they found are the ability to break down, as I mentioned, DDT, dioxins, herbicides, synthetic dyes, and turning them into food resources for the fungi. And that's just the beginning. They include breaking down oil. And a recent study from Yale was shown that they were breaking down those types of plastics that are commonly used in textiles. And so they found that one strand of fungi could survive exclusively on eating that particular type of material, you know, the synthetic materials that are coming out of the clothing. So a big positive outcome there, that we can work on those plastic stuffed landfills and bring them around with what the new findings are with the fungi.
It's so good. It's so exciting, because how long have we been really dealing with the fact that we continue to produce plastics, knowing that there's no way we have to break it down and that the planet can't handle the breaking down of that? And yet, what do? We just keep producing plastics. So to actually find that they're exploring and finding the probability, that would be great to know that we can now resolve the effects and the actual accumulation of the plastics, which is very good. I do want to share something that came up in my mind when you were saying that, most recently looking through a whole lot of the things. I kind of thrive on all of this anyway, but they recently found somewhere in the Middle East, as I remember right, I think it was Iraq, a 1,000-foot penicillin. What's the thing with a million legs?
Millipedes and centipedes.
Centipedes, okay. 1,000-foot centipede. Can you imagine that? I don't particularly like them, okay? And when I find them crawling around, I give them lots of space, or sometimes I'll pick them up and put them at a distance. But 1,000-foot one, that we actually, in our past, they have been that big. It's like, when I thought of that, the reason I recall it is because it still bothers me to know that they could be that big. You know what I mean? It's like, oh my God. So there's so much of our earth that's unfolding that we're still finding and realizing just how very long life has been and how much a part of it is. So that's real exciting to me. And it's like, I don't know if it's one of the happy things to share, but it's like, wow, did you ever think of that? The name of our show will be Did You Know? And so one of those particular times is, well, did you know there was a time that there was 1,000-foot centipedes? No, I didn't know. Okay, who's next here? Joyce, you got something you want to share?
Yes, I do. And fits right into the time and space thing. First of all, I want to say the website that was really interesting for me, it was called allthatsinteresting.com. So if anyone wants to explore further, the particular item that caught my attention was a study they did at the Lombreuse Cave. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but it's in South France. These caves are actually 260 feet high. I can't even imagine how high that is. And there's three of them, and they're all very, very long, 5 miles long, 8 miles long. And they're one of the most popular tourist places in all of the world. They're only closed on Christmas and New Year's. Otherwise, they're open to the public all through the time. So 15 volunteers decided they were willing to go into these caves for 40 days without any. They went with food and they could pump water from a well that was very deep, but they didn't have any way to measure time. So their time was totally measured by sleep cycles. And they didn't all go on the same sleep cycles. They all had a tent. So the research from this study isn't available yet.
Okay, so let's move forward. And Rosemary, what do you have to share? Something exciting?
Well, I got fungi on my list too, and I also got the case on my list. So I was thinking, oh my God, they're taking my points, but there's so much to say. Did you know, fungi has the largest organism of the earth. Actually, there's one fungi in Oregon in the Mayer National Park, and it is 2,384 acres big. And the fungi are amazing. I got really into it. I have a whole list of it. But what really is the basic point I want to say is that they discovered that fungi can make decisions and they actually have cognitive abilities. They have an intelligence, but they don't have a brain, they say. So someone said, are we vegetizing humans if thinking that the plants are maybe intelligent, or are we humanizing plants? The question I have is they discovered that fungi can change into hunting mushrooms and they're hunting nematodes. I mean, they can sense light, they can sense gravity, they can be really able to decide how much nutrients they are sending to the plants, which they live in symbiosis with. And so my question is really, and that comes to what we have been shared so far about plants, is, with fungi, I think, and with plants, we are understanding a different kind of intelligence. It is even speculated that fungi come out of space because they do survive. Some of them survive in space, and it maybe has been traveling interplanetary from other celestial bodies. And fungi already have been here when the first algae moved out of the ocean, and it was the fungi which made it possible for the algae to hold on to their mycelium, their huge network they have, so they can go on land. So is it maybe that there we are now reflected by the plants and what Mike shared and what Geraldine shared, that plants have maybe an intelligence, or we're encountering intelligence on this planet, which is not the way we use intelligence or the way we think intelligence is. And that really got me excited about that. So fungi are amazing, and they also can be trained. Like Geraldine said, they are decomposing that. Well, there's a fungi called Blairatus, which can be trained to decompose cigarette butts or crude oil or diapers or other pollutants. So I think this is really exciting to discover more about that.
Right. So you and Geraldine are kind of fixated on fungus. All right. Well, thank you all for that. Do we have any particular other subject matter? And is anyone else ready to share? How about you, Trina?
Oh, yeah. This one caught my eye, and I thought it was really interesting because I think we've probably all heard that when two or more are gathered, and the increased power of that grouping together. So this particular study said neuroscientists claim to have pinpointed the brain states unique to team flow. And we talk about flow a lot, where when people kind of get in the zone and they tune off out everything around them and they move into this place of focused activity and flow. Well, they're finding, and this is a study on it's called inneuro.org. A group of neuroscientists came together to do this study. And what they were saying is that it's possible to create team flow between the different participants in an activity, and that we seem to have an intuitive understanding with others as we work together to complete a task or complete a competition or whatever it is that we're doing. So this international team of neuroscientists uncovered this neural state unique to team flow, and it appears that these differ from the flow that we experience as individual people. So a neuroscientist, Mohammed Shahata, said, in individual flow, the brain shuts down external stimuli that are unrelated to the task. In team flow, the brain still shuts down external stimuli, except for the information about the flow state of the teammate. Hence, the team brain starts to synchronize more. I thought that was really, really interesting. So they ran this study, and the conclusion that they had when they came out, they measured everything through encephalographs, and they watched how the wave function of the brain correlated between each of the participants in the study. And so what they found was, they said, we utilized the intense task-related attention and the reduced sense of external awareness dimension of flow and the well-known effects of selective attention on auditory evoked potential. And this had to do with like creating music, doing the same kind of music. So the researchers found that the beta and gamma brain waves activity on the left middle temporal cortex reacted to these frequencies, and that the region of the brain is associated with key functions like attention, memory, and awareness, which are consistent with higher team interaction and enhancing many flow dimensions. And what was really cool about this is that as they did this study, the unique team flow was that the participants' neural activity synchronized. And as they were performing these tasks, their brains would mutually align to these neuro oscillations, bringing in frequencies from the other players. So the question that they came up with, which I thought was really fascinating, is if brains can be functionally connected through interbrain synchrony, does this mean it's not only our brain that contributes to our consciousness? And they said it's a curious question, and they're not sure yet, but based on their findings, they said they can't conclude that the high value of integrated information correlates with a modified form of consciousness, like team consciousness, but they've gotten enough results that they want to continue their studies. And I kept thinking, wow, this would be really amazing, because it does show, and you would be able to train, because we know in science already that we can train our brains to do certain things. And so can we train groups of people coming together? This could be a really fabulous information, or I don't know. It's just something that really caught my mind, that they've actually been able to locate it, measure it, get continued repetitive results out of it. And where are they going to go from here with this?
All right. Very much. Thank you very much. I want to share that one of the things that had caught my eye is, I don't know how many have actually heard this on the news, and that is that we will be releasing, if not already, I'm pretty sure it's already started, we will be releasing a developed mosquito that will now actually kill off the mosquitoes that spread some of the more horrible diseases that we have. So there, we're releasing about 1,400 of these particular male mosquitoes in southern Florida to actually start mating with the females. And at that point, we'll destroy the particular reproductive of that. So that at this point, my question is, okay, so we're creating a creature that takes care of another creature and the potential danger it has. But then when we have that in full motion, I've been looking up, and I would encourage others to look this up. At what point do we determine we've done this enough? That now, what do we do with the particular male species that has actually killed off all the females that spread the disease? What is their future, and how are they affect where we're going? So there are things that we need to ask a few more questions about before we say yay, yay. I mean, I'm happy this particular mosquito actually gives dogs heartworm problems and other things. So I'm not saying I'm okay with the mosquito that spreads the disease. But to think that we've developed an alien mosquito that's going to go in and actually take these out, what do we do once we've done that? What's the after effects in the future of that? Okay, let's move forward more. Marianne, do you have something you want to share?
Yeah, I do. Well, I obviously love making a difference in the world. So I was looking at the impact of the heart on others. And, you know, I think a lot of people don't know that the heart is really its own brain. And in fact, impacts the mind, the brain, more than the brain impacts the body. So it actually, there's more neural pathways that go up to the brain and communication with the brain. So there's lots of research that shows that the patterns of the heart actually influence how you think and how you interpret your environment and your world. And there's actually like four different pathways that go from the heart to the brain. So there's the nervous system we know about, and there's hormones. There's also pulse waves, like the biophysical communication, and then there's also an electromagnetic field that communicates from the heart to the brain. So I think it's really fascinating to look into the heart-brain communication and how the heart is its own actual brain with its own intelligence and logic.
Okay, very good. So, Michael, we're going to come back. Do you have exciting, weird, exotic, strange stuff to talk about?
Actually, I have two.
Good.
The first one I'm going to start with is has to do with California condors. Now, we all have probably an image of these majestic birds with wingspans that are just enormous, riding the thermals out in the Southwest. Well, they did a study. These birds actually came very, very close to extinction. And so in 1987, some conservationists in California collected all of the wild ones they could collect that were left. There was only 22 birds left at all. And so they brought them in and put them in a protected environment in the San Diego Wildlife Zoo Alliance and helped them start to reproduce in more of a protected environment and build up the populations before they would let them out free again. And this went on for several years. And some researchers went back and they, of course, as they were doing this, there was a lot of research going on, and they followed their genealogy, which chick had who as parents and all this kind of stuff. And in the course of doing their study, they found out that two birds that were born actually 10 years apart, both were born with no fathers, just from mothers. So there were actually asexual reproduction in condors, which they had never seen before. They confirmed it genetically that the birds have no genes at all from the father. Their only contribution comes from the mother's side. So I just thought that was really kind of amazing that something as big, I mean, I've heard about it in like some amphibians and things like that, but I've never heard about it in a bird, especially a big one like a condor, that they can produce, the females can actually produce without the males in certain situations.
Yeah, and when you go far back into study in the particular nature of life that was on the planet before that, I've actually studied that there were several species that would more like, I guess my word for it is hermaphrodite. Within itself, it has both the female and male ability to actually create it and conceive of itself. And that's always intrigued me. You know, it's like, how can that be? So you're saying that's something they've discovered recently of a present bird?
They actually had two birds that had I said they had them because both of them died. They said that neither of the birds were very robust, so they obviously weren't super healthy, and it's probably not the most genetically strongest selection. But they were saying at least maybe what it is some kind of a protection system that the species develops when it's under stress, that it actually brings these abilities forward that aren't generally there.
Wow, that is interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of
cool. Now we're on to a whole different science, right? So now we're going to discover all of this particular concern that's going on about genders. Oh my God, what are we going to do about this one, right?
You got it.
Yeah. All right. You said you had two.
Yes, the other one has to. Well, let me ask you a question, or let me ask everybody the question. If I said to you, let's have a little bet here, and I'll bet you that a wooden knife is sharper than a stainless steel knife, would you take that bet? Would you bet against me? Could you believe that a wooden knife could be sharper than a stainless steel knife? Well, in fact, some researchers at the University of Maryland, the Mechanical Engineering Department, were doing some research on hardwoods, and they were trying to find out how they can their whole goal is how can we replace things that we make right now that are very energy expensive. Making steel is very energy expensive. Making ceramics is very energy expensive. So they were looking at wood. And what they found was they were able to boil the wood just at, you know, normal, like whatever, 212 degrees Fahrenheit or 100 degrees C. And they were able to remove the part, basically the squishy part inside the wood, the lignin and the cellulose, and they take all of the moisture out of it, compact the wood down, and in fact, they're able to make it very, and then they roll it, and it becomes super dense to the point where it's stronger. They can make a sharpened edge that's three times sharper than a stainless steel edge.
Oh, wow.
And so their whole idea here is that we don't necessarily want to try to, you know, make everything out of wood, but here's a way to show that you can take something that you wouldn't think you could normally replace because it's so sophisticated the way it's made, and replace it with something that's relatively easy to do. I mean, anybody can get water boiling, and if they put the hardwood in that they were using and put it under enough pressure, you can create this kind of a use. So I thought that was kind of cool too.
Wow, I think that is cool. So anyone have any more comment they would like to make on that? I mean, you could have never convinced me wood would have outdone steel.
Well, they said what's really neat was they said that they can, afterwards they press it, it can be carved into different shapes. It can be coated with mineral oil to extreme, you know, to increase its lifespan. And they put this knife that they made through several cycles in the dishwasher, and they said it never lost its edge.
Very, 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 very interesting. All right, very good. Anyone else have some particular abstract sharings and stuff that comes up that are not normal studies? We're not teaching studies and things that are logical, beloved co-host. We were talking about the bizarre and the weird. So you better get bizarre or weird or keep it for next week. So anybody got anything else on that level you want to share?
I have a very unusual vacation spot that I think people will either say yuck or interesting. In South Korea, there is a place that every single year tourists turn out in huge numbers to bathe in the mud. And they, in the film that I watched, they arrived in all these beautiful clothing, and bit by bit they submerged themselves, even their whole face and their hair, looking as happy as can be, all having a good time being submerged in the mud. And it took me back to studying Anne Wigmore years ago, when she actually had a place where she did submerge people in the mud for healing. So I don't know whether the people having their vacation go away healed, but it was definitely a different vacation choice.
All right, very good. Anybody else?
I had two, actually. One's a really quick one. It's a brand new species just identified, and it's called Nicotina insecta. And for anyone who knows nicotine, then that's like cigarettes. So it's this plant that was found in a truck stop in Australia, just looked like a really ordinary plant, but had dead insects all over it. Somehow it attracts the insects, and then it uses nicotine to kill them. So it didn't need any scientific studies to say nicotine in that particular case had some toxic ability. So we've got Nicotina insecta, brand new discovery in Australia. And interesting that it's when you stop at a truck stop and hop out and actually look around, you might not think that there's things brand new to science still, but that was one of them. And the other one was, again, more information on how many bacteria and other organisms live on us. So new research has shown that there's more than 1.5 trillion, that's a one with 12 zeros, of bacteria that live on our average 1.8 meters squared of skin. So you want most of this bacteria. It's not about rubbing it off. It's actually keeping us alive and doing many of the processes. So what this scientific paper is saying is there's potentially more cells that make up what we'd call our body, and our both internally and externally, that are other organisms. So if we think that we're all about competing, we really need to look that we are an example of a great big cooperation, not only of our own cells, but a whole lot of different organisms, different species of bacteria and other microbes. So how's that? 1.5 trillion just on our skin.
I know. Whoa, 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 right. There was some particular items I was looking at, speaking of Australia, that about 50 years ago, a particular meteorite landed on your particular continent. And the research they've done with this, they realized that this meteorite brought stardust to our planet that actually existed before our sun, so that we actually can trace and understand life before our planet actually began to evolve with the sun. So when we look at how extraordinary and far-reaching different discoveries are and different things that are out there, that just because they don't seem to fit in the normal flow of whatever day-to-day is, and that we don't ever have contact with. Well, in knowing that everything is energy, you have to ask what kind of impact and what kind of emanations does a meteorite like that have? And what are the effects that it actually releases into the atmosphere of our planet? So that when we realize we're constantly being bombarded with meteorites and particular things coming through our particular systems, our Earth is always being affected by something in indefinitely space-time situations. And how does that affect us as we evolve? Well, to have any kind of thought on how it affects us, we have to be interested enough to read about it, to study it, and be interested in it. But I found that very, very amusing to me, to think we actually have something we can study that's older than our sun and actually came to our planet just 50 years ago. So how long it's been floating around out there, right? And how much more it's gathered. And to me, the first thing that cropped up in my mind is, I don't know that I can even think of a world before the sun. I mean, we're in what we've been taught, the history we have, we see the sun as the beginning, and we just, you know, that's our evolution. And to realize, no, it was evolving long before the sun was our star. Okay, so I found that excited. Things like that grab my attention and create moments, if not minutes and hours, of thought from me. So do we have anything else that someone would like to share? We have a few minutes here.
I would like to share something which also smashes, and I think there's more coming, our ideas about history. Did you know that there's a study which proves or is saying that cavemen, which lived 40,000 years ago, so-called primitive cavemen, we call them, have been as intellectual able as we are today? What they did is they actually studied the artworks across Europe in all these caves. You probably know about all these depictions of these beautiful animals in the caves and all that. And they found out that these people were already able 40,000 years ago to track time. They knew about equinoxes, and they were actually able to define dates within 250 years. And how did they do that? Well, they basically compared the chemical dating the paint they used with the position of stars in ancient times. And they say that the animal symbols represent star constellations in the night sky, and they were used to mark certain events like comet strikes or other things. And they say that this finding is really telling to us that the course of human development is quite different than what we think. And I think we will find out more about that in the future, too.
Yeah, that sounds good, too. All right, we're going to bring this week's program close. And the new program that we're piloting here is called Did You Know? Okay, and we will be looking for that to start probably mid of November or toward the end of November. So we will be arranging that with our production and our network, which is Law of Attraction Network. So be aware, keep your eyes open and look for it. And some of the familiar faces you may hear from here or there, but basically it will be actually moving and plodding through a new space. So we thank our co-hosts for actually doing their best to stay weird. I want to tell you all, you have a hard time getting weird, okay? And definitely not bizarre. So we're looking for more bizarre, weird stuff. You got where you wanted to give science. I'm not looking for science. I'm looking for somebody to keep them up at night. So we thank you for giving your best for today's show. And a lot of it was extremely interesting. So we're going to go now. And we thank you for coming in to Law of Attraction Book Club. Law of Attraction Network and Quantum Leap Book Club. Okay, I got that. And so we're going to actually start a book next week. And we'll be sending that out through our communications. I'm opening for a lot of communication on your particular responses on actually how the show could run. Okay. Thank you very much and have a fantastic week. OCO.
Thank you for listening to Quantum Leap Book Club. For more information where you can contact us, go to loaradionetwork.com/quantum-leap. Have a great week.